Hey, how are you?
My name is Roy Brooks. I'm always having class rules right after. I never really get a chance to ask you a question.
Sure.
Just really briefly, I know before you made claims that the U.S. economy thought maybe it was going to mature almost decline state, but I've always come to the belief that, you know, economies don't really like decline, maybe it's sort of growth. It's always just transition and different like assets.
That's not true. Economies, look at the history of economies.
You think it is?
Of course. Economies age.
Just growth rate or just... stagnation.
Well, but just, you know, you'll have low growth. You're not going to have 3% growth, you're going to have 1% growth because you are 40% of the global economy. Right? Same thing will happen to China. It's not a question of the U.S. It's any economy as it gets to be larger and larger has less capacity to grow at other people's expense. Right? So U.S. companies could still grow because they're multinational. You don't have U.S.
companies. But the U.S. economy...
Exactly. So what's increasingly happening around the world is companies and economies are disconnected. So you can have an economy do badly, but companies can do well. So that's, I think, you know, that's what can make it frustrating is, you know, you try to connect the two and you can get into some serious issues.
So we always look for the disconnect. Don't always assume that because
exactly.
Maybe operating more specifically than one company,
exactly.
That is contributing so more fully to the growth of the economy.
As we saw, China has a bigger role to play in how U.S. companies do than the U.S.
Because I was thinking more along the lines of, like, the more you see now, the technological revolution, how just, like, the increasing rates, even, like, Moore's Law.
But the margin rate of productivity hasn't changed in the U.S. for 30 years instead of all this stuff. So. Okay, let's get settled in. Three things today. Two you've heard of before. Everybody's in a group, right? Is there anybody who's not in a group still? Okay. Who does not have a company picked out yet? Everybody has a company. So you know what that means, right? If I call on you and say, what's the risk-free rate in the currency that you're doing your company in, you should have an answer, right? I won't do that. But remember, as we go through this process, I might just say, okay, you told me you have a company. What was the beta you got for your company? And you might have to say, I don't have a company yet. And if I don't have a company yet, all the rest. So pick a damn company. Let's get moving, okay, if you haven't picked one. Third, and this is my unpleasant duty, your first quiz is a week from Wednesday. You know that? If you don't know that, the Google Calendar has been out there. You should have known it right from the beginning. It's a week from Wednesday. Remember the rules. It's open book, open notes, first 30 minutes, not last 30 minutes. So if you come in 20 minutes late, it's over, right? It's first 30 minutes of the Wednesday class next week, and there will be class after the quiz. So don't leave. Okay? The TAs are having their session, so if you want, if you feel that you're really, really lost, you can go to that. But my suggestion is you start preparing. Remember, every past quiz I've ever given is online. So you can't complain. You've never seen something like this before because you will. And if you're going to miss the quiz, and if you're going to think of a good reason, start thinking now. Okay? I need to know before the quiz. Before. So it has to be before 3:30. You know why? Because otherwise I give you a free option. Class this large, you take the quiz, you don't do well, you slip it in your backpack and say, I was never there. I have no way of knowing. So basically you have to let me know before the quiz that you're not going to be there. So 3:26, 3:27, I'll check the email step. 3:28, 3:29, 3:29:47, 3:29, you kind of get the picture. So it has to be before the quiz. Open book, open notes, so I'm not checking you on. So what we're going to be doing in, what we did in the last two sessions and what we're going to be doing in these next three are going to be critical because that's a number crunching part of the quiz. Right? One final thing. There you go, I promised you a gift. There's your gift. He answered all three questions, right? So I deliver on my promise. So next time I say, if anybody answers these questions, I'll give you something. If you don't want the book, obviously, don't jump in. But no, I'll think of something. Okay? So let's pick up where we left off. Okay? So let's go back very quickly and review where we are. Risk-free rate, if I ask you what risk-free rate you're using, what's the answer going to be? In what currency? And once you pick the company, you shouldn't be asking me that question. You should know already. And the risk-free rate is more difficult to get in some currencies than others. When I ask you what equity risk premium you're using for your company, how do you come up with that? What do you have to start with? But first, start with your company, right? Before you go looking for market rates, because you can get market rates for 150 countries, you have to be looking for where your company gets its revenues. And then you go looking for, do you see why the sequence has to go that way? Because without knowing the six countries or the 12 or the 15, you're going to be looking at the global picture saying, what do I do now? So you're going to take the revenue breakdown, you're going to take a weighted average, you got your equity risk premium. And we started on the beta part, the last measure that we need. And we said the beta measures your risk as a company. And we went through the conventional process, we run a regression. So today I want to go through that conventional process of estimating betas. Remember I said it's a regression of returns on your stock against returns on a market index. And I talked about the choices you have to make. So let me start with the choices I made for Disney. And then I'll show you what the regression looks like. So this class is going to be part statistics, part finance. Not too much statistics, just very surface level statistics and part finance. So I want to estimate a beta for Disney. I decided to go back 5 years. Why 5 years? Because I like 5 years. I could do two, three. I don't want to go back 25 years because I get a very different company, so I went back 5 years. I decided to look at monthly returns. Why monthly? Because, again, I like monthly returns. If you like weekly returns, be my guest. So I have monthly returns for 5 years. I'm going to have 60 months of data. I estimated returns each month. You're saying, what does that even mean? What are the two ways you make money on stocks? One is you get dividends, which you get how often every year? It depends on the company. Most U.S. companies actually pay quarterly dividends, which means you get them once every 3 months, which means if I'm doing monthly returns, don't try to be fair and try to give dividends every month. That's not the way the world works. You might get dividends in March and June, September and December. You're saying, wouldn't that affect the returns in those months? Don't worry. It'll take care of itself. What's the other way you make money? Or the change in the price, right? The price change from month to month. That could be positive. It could be negative. It depends on the month. So each month, here's what I did. I took the price at the start of the month, the price at the end of the month. So, for instance, if I take November, end of November of 2009, Disney was at $30.22. End of December, it was at $32.25. So it went up $2.03 during the month. During the month, it happened to be what's called an ex-dividend month. That is a month in which you get dividends. There was a 35-cent dividend. So during December, here's what you'd have made as a Disney investor. You'd have made $2.03 as price change, plus the 35-cent dividend, divided by what you paid at the start of the month. Why at the start of the month? Because that's what you actually invested. Your percentage return for that month would have been 7.88%. So think of this as an Excel spreadsheet. I do this month after month after month. I compute the returns. If there's a dividend, I count it. If there's no dividend, I just take the price change. I get the percentage returns on Disney every month for 59 months. What happened? I thought I had 60 months of data. Why did I end up with 59 months of returns? I need a price change, right? So the first month, I just have a price. So it's first return is going to show up in the second month, and then I get 59 months of returns. Then I went looking for a market index. I decided to use the S&P 500. For the moment, if you have questions, let's hold back on it, because let me get the mechanics done. I used the S&P 500 as my index. Every month, I computed the return on the S&P 500. And there again, there are two components of returns. I'm going to get the change in the index from month to month. That's the 1,095 to 1,115. And I'm also going to get dividends on all those 500 companies. Some will pay, some will not. The collective dividend, that's the dividend for the month. The percentage return in that month for the market was 1.78%. And I do this again for 59 months. So think of this Excel spreadsheet you're done with. You have 59 months of returns on your stock, 59 months of returns on a market index. What do I want you to do? Run a regression, right? You've taken statistics somewhere along the way, right? Don't act like you haven't. You have. Okay? And in statistics, before you run, this is a simple regression. Dependent variable against an independent variable. I was taught, and maybe you weren't, that before you run a regression, you should see it as a picture. It's called a scatter plot. What I do in a scatter plot is I take each month, I take the returns on the stock, and I plot it. So see these blue points? Each of them is a month of data. If you are a type A personality and you don't trust me, count the number of blue points. There should be 59 blue points if you don't trust me, because each month of data will be there. So when I'm done with the scatter plot, all I have are the blue points. And I have to fit a regression line, a best fit line. Now, how do I get that best fit line? Can I sit there and eyeball the data and say, that looks good? That looks better. What's the standard in statistics for getting the best fit line in a regression? Somebody said least squared. Who said that said least squared? How exactly does that work? You minimize the least squared distance from the line. In fact, in the old Greek days, that's how they ran regressions. Is a guy would sit there and measure the distance from the line, square the distance, write it down. So thank God we have computers that do it for us. But they minimize the squared distances. So thank God for regression packages. It runs a regression for you. It fits it. So there's your best fit line. And there's the output from the regression. Disney is your dependent variable. The market is your independent variable. The intercept, 0.0071, is where it crosses the line. The slope is 1.25. What did we say the beta was? It's the slope of the regression. So if you trust this regression, the beta for Disney is 1.25. You're saying, what does that mean? If you trust this regression, Disney is 1.25 times more risky than the average stock in the market, if you trust the regression. But time for some truth in advertising. This is a regression. I fit a line. I've got a slope. But if this were a statistics class, I can't just say, this is the line. I've got to give you my standard error and my estimate. That 0.10 is the standard error in my slope. We'll come back and talk about how to use it. But basically, I have a regression, I have an intercept, I have a slope, I have a standard error in the slope. And to complete the statistics, I also report an R squared of about 73%. So here's what I'm going to do for the next 30 minutes. I'm going to take this regression apart, because it tells me, the way to think about this regression is, let's say you're a doctor and I'm a new patient who comes in. And the first thing you do is you order a panel of tests. You look at that panel to see whether I have diabetes, essentially the panel of tests is your first chance to see what my health looks like as a patient. Think of this as the equivalent. You've just picked your company. You're getting ready to do the analysis. You've run a regression. Think of this as your first insight into some, because every piece of this regression is going to help me tell you a story about the company. So let me try reading this regression. First, let's start with the intercept. What did I say the intercept tells us about a company? How well or badly this stock did during the period of the regression, right? So what I did was I started with the intercept, which was, remember that 0.0071, that's in percent. So I made it 0.712%. That's my intercept. And I said to make a judgment on whether that was a good number or a bad number, I had to compare it to the risk-free rate times 1 minus beta. The risk-free rate times 1 minus beta is what I'd expect the stock to do if it did exactly what the CAPM predicted. The risk-free rate during this period was 0.5% a year. That was my annualized rate. Because I'm doing everything in monthly terms, I divided by 12. Why? Because I want to make sure I'm comparing apples to apples. So if I had used a weekly return regression, I wouldn't have divided by 12, I'd have divided by 52. If I'd used daily returns, I'd have used 365. So essentially, I'm making the risk-free rate into a monthly risk-free rate, 0.042%. I multiply that by 1 minus the beta, that 1.252 is the beta from the previous page, I get minus 0.0105%. You're saying, what does that mean? If Disney had done exactly as predicted during the period of the regression, the intercept should have been minus 0.01%. It actually was 0.71%. The difference between those two numbers, 0.71 minus of minus 0.01 is 0.72%. That's called the Jensen's alpha. What does that tell you about Disney? On a monthly basis between 2008 and 2013, Disney did 0.72% better than expected, given its risk and given what the market did during the period. Now, part of you saying 0.72%, who cares? That's each month. On an annualized basis, if you think about earning that every month, that's about 9% better than expected. So let me give you a way to think about this 9%. Let's make life very simple. Let's assume you buy a stock with a beta of 2. What does that mean? The stock is twice as risky as the market. Let's say the market is up 20%. How much would you need to make on this stock to break even? You'd have to make 40%. You think you're being greedy. You're not, because if you're risky and you don't make money when the market is up, you're going to, essentially, don't build up some fat on the way up. You're going to have nothing to burn off on the way down. So you have to make 40%. So if you make exactly 40%, your Jensen's alpha is zero. So if Disney were a stock with a beta of 2 in a market which is up 20%, and I told you the Jensen's alpha is 9%, I'm saying it made 40% plus an extra 9%. So the Jensen's alpha measures how good or bad Disney was as an investment between 2008 and 2013. Question?
So you assume all the returns come from...
We don't know. Basically, all we know at this stage is they made 9% more. Whether it was because, and that's going to be my next question, where did that extra 9% come from? Was it because Disney was a really well-managed company? So we'll come back and talk about that. Yeah. Well, in a sense, if you're a risky company, that is basically what it expects. So in a month in which the market is down 10%, if you have a stock with a beta of 1.5, you should be down 15%. So that's basically my measurement mechanism against which I'm going to compare the actual returns. Okay? So that's my Jensen's alpha for Disney. Let's dig a little deeper on this Jensen's alpha. Let's assume that I computed what I did for Disney for every single stock in the market. I start with A, work all the way down to Z, Jensen's alpha for every stock, all 2,000, 3,000 stocks. Ready? So I've got 2,000. What should the average Jensen's alpha across all stocks be? It should be zero. Do you see why? Shouldn't matter whether the market went up or down? It will be zero, and here's why. If you tell me the collective Jensen's alpha across all stocks is plus 5%, here's what you've just told me. Stocks collectively beat themselves by 5%. That can't happen. A Jensen's alpha is a market-adjusted, risk-adjusted measure. So if the market's doing really well, all stocks, the expected returns will be much higher. So this is over and above what you need to make. So that's the first stop. So when you get a stock with a Jensen's alpha of plus 2%, don't bitch and moan about the fact that you got only plus 2%. Be happy that it's plus. You think that's a pretty low standard? What do we say the average portfolio manager makes relative to the market? Minus 1.5%. So at plus 2%, you're doing great. You are better than the typical portfolio manager, perhaps even the 80th percentile. Don't get greedy. My definition of good portfolio management is collectively, not even every stock, collectively of your portfolio. If it looks like I'm crying, my allergies are kicking in. Now, so when you look at a portfolio, you're looking at the collective Jensen's alpha across the portfolio. Now let's take another step. If you look at that Jensen's alpha of let me play the role of Bob Iger. Who's Bob Iger? I'm the CEO of Disney between this period. You're my stockholders. I show you this number. This is good, right? I beat the market by 9%. So I say, look, guys, I did a good job for you. I should get a bonus. What do you think? You see the question I'm asking? When you see a positive Jensen's alpha for a company, is it because managers have done a good job? Tell me why. So that's okay. So yeah, that's the right answer, but tell me why. Okay, so first is it could be luck. Okay, that's a good point. It could be luck. But if I do 3 years in a row or 5 years in a row, obviously it can't be luck. But couldn't I argue that I was the one who went to China and... So in a sense, you can argue that as management, by going global, I saved you from that domestic problem. Of course, the problem is next year if China collapses, you're going to come back and say, well, the same thing that made... So that could be, but again, it's not a sustainable reason. Yes? It's just not, why is that a bad thing? So if the market is down 20%, you get a stock that's down only 6%, you should be dancing in the street, right? That's still good. So if you have a bank that was down only 10% in 2009, that guy deserved, you know, a halo. Yeah. I'm sorry? Hey, if you can push up your return by just giving out too many dividends, keep doing it. Because ultimately, what do I care about? Do I make money? How I make money is irrelevant. You buy back stock, you do dividends. You seem to be all pushing in my, you know, my getting a bonus. So this is all good for me. Yeah.
Should the manager have known that he was going
to
get that
alpha? No, let's not go there because the manager is not God, right? A lot of this is driven by lots of different choices you make, right?
Unless he was telling the shareholder that his expectations were different than the markets,
No, the managers don't tell shareholders what their expectations need to be. Shareholders set their expectations. So managers don't set the game. This is not like a football game saying, I'm going to win by 20 points and you win by 23. You just play the game and people make their own judgments. You go bet in Vegas and say, we're going to win by 6. So he won by not just the spread, but 8%, 8 points more. Okay. Let me give you a clue. If I computed the Jensen's alpha for oil companies, you can take the entire list for the last 2 years, every single oil company. What am I going to find as a Jensen's alpha for every single oil company? They're all going to be negative. Why? Oil prices went from $90 a barrel to $27 a barrel. You could be the best managed oil company in the world, but you're screwed. That's a finance term, so I feel okay using it. Because there's nothing you could do. You see where I'm going? If you're in a sector that is doing well for whatever reason, your Jensen's alphas could all be great, but it's not nothing you did. So how do I correct for that? What do I need to do? If I'm called into Disney and say, you decide whether this is Bob Iger's job or whether somebody else did it, what do I need to get as my second statistic? Exactly. I have to compare the Jensen's alpha of Disney to the Jensen's alpha for other entertainment companies, and they're all collectively making 15% Jensen's alphas, and you're making only 9%. I'm going to say, I'm going to take back some of your pay. Maybe I won't do that, but I'm definitely not going to give you a bonus. If you go to my website, I have Jensen's alphas by sector. That's why I have it. Because when I compute the Jensen's alpha for a company, I need to compare it to something to make that judgment. So don't be too quick to look at a stock that has done well and say, hey, there must be a well-managed company. It could be luck. It could also be that you're in the right sector at the right time. And it's really nothing you did that made the Jensen's alpha positive. Now let me ask you a final question. Let's say this is November of 2013. I do the computation. I show you the Jensen's alpha. Jensen's alpha across the last 5 years was plus 9%. The stock did whatever you expected to do, plus an extra 9%. You're an investor looking at the stock in November of 2013. Does the fact that this stock has had a positive Jensen's alpha over the past 5 years make this a good investment, a bad investment, or is absolutely no, it's useless information from the perspective of whether it's a good or a bad investment? What do you think? Make a guess. It doesn't have to be a definitive answer. You don't think it's good? And reason out why you think it's no effect.
Because the market's now valued it with the past
In other words, when a stock does better than expected, what happens to its price? Think of a Google, right? Has done better than expected. The price starts to rise because people say it's a good company. Because if it were this easy, we'd all be rich, right? Because all we need to do is pick the 50 stocks that went up the most over the last 5 years, take all our money and put in the 50 stocks, and then sit down and just wait for them to make us more money. In fact, if there's any evidence in finance, it actually cuts in the other direction. You know what I mean by the other direction? If you want to make money in the next 5 years, you shouldn't be buying the stocks with the best Jensen's alphas. You should be buying the stocks with the worst Jensen's alphas. Why? Because they're going to be beaten up. GoPro, horrible Jensen's alpha right now. Stock was at about 86 2 years ago. It's at 12. You don't even have to do regressions and Jensen's. I'll save you the trouble. Horrible investment. If you invested 2 years ago. This morning, I valued GoPro. I'm going to put it on my blog tomorrow. I'm going to buy GoPro tomorrow. Why am I doing it? Not because of their past record. That'd be crazy to do it. I'm doing it because they've been beaten up so badly and people have given up on them that the price at this point makes them a good investment. Okay. So again, don't make this an autopilot. I'm just going to take the 50 biggest losers from last year and buy them because you'll have 50 bad oil companies in your portfolio. Okay. But at least think about it. So don't be automatic about picking good stocks just because they've been good stocks in the past. Question?
So if you look at companies like that and the fact that they've done poorly in the past as maybe about in the future, why would you endorse data and capital?
No, but wait. I did not say I'd like GoPro because it had done badly in the past. What did I say I did this morning? I valued the company. Valuing the company means more than just buying the company because it's down, right? Valuing the company means looking at its products, its business model, its revenues, its cash flows. And once I get that, what do I need to discount them back to today to get a sense of the value? I need a hurdle rate. So I still need all that architecture to get an estimate of what's GoPro worth today. So when you see my value of GoPro at $24, which is where I came up with, I needed to go through that process. So there are lots of companies that have gone down a lot over the last 2 years that I'm not touching with a 10-foot pole. I actually valued LinkedIn as well, which is also down 50% just in the last month. It's gone down. It's less overvalued than it used to be a month ago, but it still looks overvalued to me. So to me, it's not automatic. I still have to bring in that valuation architecture, but you know, at least based on my estimate of value, GoPro looks like a good investment. So any questions on Jensen's alphas? So if you're a stock picker, what do you hope to see at the end of every year when you tally your Jensen's alphas across your portfolio? Don't be over-optimistic and expect to see all of them have positive Jensen's alphas. Nobody ever wins all of the time. Keep your threshold. You don't have to be right to make money. You just have to be less wrong than everybody else. Remind yourself, that's an investment axiom that will save you ulcers and all kinds of pain. Is if you want to be right in every investment, this isn't the place for you. If you're right 51, 52, 53% of the time, you're way ahead of the game. If your collective Jensen's alpha is positive, celebrate, even if it's only 1% or 2%. You're saying, I'll never get rich. No, that's not why you invest. You don't invest to get rich. You invest to make sure that if you're rich already, you don't get poor. Right? So if you invest for the same reasons you go into a casino, I'll save you the trouble. You're going to end up with the same outcome you get when you go into a casino. You're going to end up losing all your money because you keep overreaching. So first stop on Jensen's alphas, everybody's comfortable, right? Let's move on to the second stop. I ran the regression. I have a beta for the regression. I also gave you the standard error of the regression. I'm going to check out some statistics and see how much you remember of your statistics. Remember I said that when I started this beta discussion, that when I go into investment bank, I ask the question, where do betas come from? And they tell me it comes from Barra, it comes from Bloomberg, it comes from somewhere else. So let me be your beta, or you be my beta service, because I want you to ask the tough questions. I'm going to be an investment banker. I'm lazy as hell. I sit around 16 hours a day, but most of the time I'm doing nothing. So at 9 o'clock at night, I wake up finally. Oh, my God, I've been sitting here all day doing nothing. I need a beta for Disney. So you ready? You're my service. I'm going to call you. It's old-fashioned. I actually physically pick up the phone and call you. Say, okay, service, I want a beta for Disney. And you have the regression in front of you. So let's start easy. If I asked you for a single number, a point estimate, based on that regression, what's the beta for Disney? You remember the regression? The beta for Disney is 1.25. If you really want to impress me, you go 1.2517. Fourth decimal point nailed down. Then I say, okay, and then you get ready to hang up the phone because you're afraid of the next question. They say, wait, that was a nice answer, but I want with 67% confidence a range on that beta. It's not a whole lot of confidence. You could be wrong a third of the time. But why did I pick 67%? In statistics, that's one standard error in either direction. What's the standard error here? It's 0.10. So with 67% confidence, what's your range going to be? 1.15 to 1.35, right? You have a 1.25 minus 0.10 plus 0.0. Okay? 95% confidence is two standard errors. 1.05. You see where I'm going? Don't think of betas as facts. They're estimates. That's why you can look up the beta for a company on five different services, and you're going to get five different numbers because they're drawing from a distribution. So don't email me saying, I got a beta from Yahoo Finance, it's 1.23. I went to Bloomberg, it was 1.17. What should I do now? Nothing to do. It's just distributions. You're going to get numbers that are different. Yes? In fact, when you run regressions, coefficients are normally distributed, even though the variables might not be. So that's one of the nice things about regression statistics, is they are actually normally distributed. So my beta for Disney, so we're starting to learn more about the company. It was a good investment between 2008 and 2013. Its beta has a point estimate of 1.25 with a range of 1.15 to 1.35 or 1.05 to 1.45, depending on how precise you want to get. Which brings me to my point about betas. When you look at the 0.10, you think of it as a big number, saying, hey, it must be just Disney. This is the dirty little secret of beta estimation that no service ever wants to admit to. Because services like to act like they give you facts. You ask for the beta, 1.31, 1.35. But here's the reality. That 0.10 that you saw for Disney was a low number relative to most U.S. companies. The median standard error for a beta estimate in the U.S. is between 0.20 and 0.25. Think of what I've just said. Next time you hear somebody say the beta for Coca-Cola is 1.12, if they were really telling the truth, given this standard error, the true beta could be anywhere from 0.72 to 1.52. There's a huge range around betas. And if you take a company like LinkedIn, you know what the beta is going to look like? The beta might be 1.6. The standard error would be 0.75. Why? It's a young company, lots of stuff going on, which means regression betas are going to be hugely noisy. Noisy is a statistical term for there's a big range on the number. So second stop, the beta tells you with noise what the risk of the company is. Which brings me to my third and final number from the regression, the R-squared. The R-squared for Disney was 73%. So 73% of the variance in the stock comes from the market. 27% is from the firm. What does that mean? We talked about the next movie that Disney will have, Jungle Book. If it does well or does badly, we worry about it. You know where it's going to show up? In the 27%. Risks that affect just the company show up in the 27%. So as you diversify, that 27% is what's going to leave your portfolio. So let me ask you a question about this R-squared, because there's a very interesting thing that's been happening to R-squared for U.S. stocks over the last decade. Pre-2008, the typical R-squared for a U.S. company was about 30%. The R-squared, 30% of the risk in a typical U.S. company came from the market, 70% from the firm. Since 2008, R-squareds have jumped to about 50 to 60%. How would I read that jump? Why is it happening? What does it tell me as an investor? Why do you think R-squareds have gone up post-2008? Globalization, but fill in the rest. Why does globalization make more of my risk into market risk? And also feed in, what was 2008? It was a crisis, right? What's the definition of a crisis? People come in and they sell everything, right? That's the nature of a crisis. People come in, they don't say, oh, this is a good company. They're not even thinking, they sell everything. And when you sell everything, what are you going to have? Everything's going to drop, good stuff as well as bad stuff. So we've been almost in a perpetual crisis mode since 2008. Right? First you had the 2000, then you had the Greek crisis, then you had the Ukraine crisis, then you have the China crisis, there'll be some other crisis, and then there'll be some. So the essence of a crisis-driven mentality is more of the risk in your stock is going to come from the market, less is going to be firm-specific. Doesn't mean you shouldn't diversify, it just means that don't expect miracles to happen when you diversify, because the nature of risk is shifting around the world. Right? One final point. If you're an investor, what does this tell you? The fact that R squared is high, what does it tell you about investing? How many of you have read Ben Graham's Security Analysis or gone to Omaha to the value, the investors, Woodstock kind of thing? If you go to old-time value investors, they give you very simple advice. They say, just value a company. Don't worry about the macro world. That advice might have worked pre-2008 because the macro world was only 30%. The micro world was 70%. So if you did good valuations, you could expect to get rewarded. Guess what? You could do everything right in this market and get slaughtered by one crisis somewhere that you had absolutely no way of forecasting. Again, it is what it is. It has to change the way we think about investing, change the way we allocate our assets. But that's what I see when I see these higher R squares, is I have to worry about macro risk in a way that I did not have to pre-2008. So now let's do the final piece in R squared. So R squared tells me how much of the risk is market risk, right? So let's assume I'm comparing Disney to Amgen. Let's assume everything else about them is the same. Same growth rate, same beta. And the only difference between the two stocks is that Disney has an R squared of 73%. And you know what Amgen does? It's a biotechnology slash pharmaceutical company. Amgen has an R squared of 25%. Okay, you ready? If those two stocks, everything else about them looks the same, one has a high R squared, the other has a low R squared. If you're a diversified portfolio manager, you're Fidelity Magellan, and you're trying to decide between these two stocks, which one of these two stocks would you rather have in your portfolio? A high R-squared stock or a low R-squared stock? And tell me why.
I'd rather have Amgen because you can diversify 75% of your risk.
Okay, so that's a good point. So if you buy Amgen, you can diversify 75%. And after you've diversified away the risk, what are you going to be left with? 25%, which is captured with a beta of 1.25. So let's say you bought Disney instead. You'll diversify the 27%. And after you've diversified the 27%, what are you going to be left with? Risk that's captured with a beta of 1.25. So after you've done diversifying, they both will look exactly the same in your portfolio. You see where I'm going? If you're a diversified investor, you don't care about R squared because what's not R squared is all going to get diversified away anyway. But if you're crazy uncle, you know what I'm talking about? The one who sat next to you at Thanksgiving and harassed you about mutual funds because he doesn't trust them. He buys only three stocks. That's it. Everything else is a conspiracy. So he comes to you because you look trustworthy. Or you're stuck next to him at Thanksgiving again. He says, look, you're taking a business class, right? You know a lot about finance. I need some advice. Which three stocks should I buy? My advice is don't answer. Crazy uncles, nothing good ever comes out of advice you give. But it's an uncle. You can't not say something. So my question is a generic one. If you're advising with a diversified investor, we said it doesn't matter. But with your crazy uncle, would you want him to hold three stocks with high R squareds or three stocks with low R squareds? Tell me why. In other words, if he put his three, let's say he decided to buy LinkedIn, Yelp, and Yahoo with his money. He said, I've heard good things will happen. They're low R-squared stocks, right? So what happens, he's exposed to a tremendous amount of risk in those stocks, and he's not going to get rewarded for most of them. So if you're not diversified, you want to go with the high R-squared. In fact, if you can trick him, ask him to buy the stock called SPX. It's actually the S&P 500 rolled up as a spider. So he moves exactly like the market every day. This is a miracle. Don't let him see what he's bought. Now, it's a perfect investment for him. He just got a diversified portfolio without even realizing he got diversified. Now, one of the great mysteries is, how can you have two stocks with the same beta and have two different R-squareds? Do you see where I'm going? We said R-squared measures the proportion of your risk that's market risk. So shouldn't Disney have a much higher beta than Amgen because its R-squared is higher? How do you reconcile those two? Or maybe I should save this for your quiz. No, actually, let's do it here. That's the moral judgment you've just passed. No, so I'm not sure whether I want to pass that judgment yet, because the R squared tells me nothing about the Jensen's alpha. It could be a negative, positive. But how can they end up with the same beta then? Do you see what I'm saying? See, I can see why you can end up with different R squareds. I can tell you lots of stories, but how do you end up with different R squareds and the same beta? I'll give you, you want to try? No. That's exactly it. What does R-squared measure? The proportion of your risk that is market risk, right? I'll give you an analogy. It's absolutely stupid, but hang in there with me anyway. What if I told you that Shaquille O'Neal, 5% of Shaquille O'Neal's weight is body fat, and 10% of my weight is body fat? This is, I'm just making up numbers, so don't get back to him about this. I don't want to be beaten up by Shaquille. Okay, so 5% of his weight is body fat, 10% of my weight is body fat. Then I ask you a very simple question. Who amongst us has more pounds of body fat? I have 10% of my weight. I should have more, but 10%, on a good day I weigh 125, on a bad day I weigh 120. 10% of my weight is 12.5 pounds. Shaquille O'Neal on any day weighs like 500 pounds. 5% of 500 pounds is going to be 27 and a half pounds. Do you see where I'm going? Amgen has a lot of risk. 25% of that total risk can still be a lot of units of risk. Beta measures how many units of risk you have. So you can have a high R squared and a low beta, a high R squared and a high beta, low R squared and a low. So don't just look at the R squared and say, hey, the R squared is low, therefore my beta has to be low, because you're a very risky company. Many of these tech companies have very low R-squareds, but can end up with high betas because you're looking at a much bigger total risk to allocate across the two. Right? So until about 1997, or later than that, actually 2002, 2003, when we got to this point in the class, I would have asked each of you to go run a regression. What would that involve? Go collect 60 months of prices on your stock, 60 months on the index, put it into an Excel spreadsheet, run the regression. It's not difficult, it's tedious. You can get it off Yahoo Finance, put in the numbers. And if any of you feel the urge to do it, go ahead and do it. But there is actually a shortcut you can use that will allow you to get the beta of your company much more quickly. And that requires finding one of the Bloomberg terminals, which is wherever it is in the building. And this is actually the last part of the email I sent you. Some of you might have done. How many of you actually did this? Okay, good to know. Okay. So I'll send it again. You know, I'll keep nagging you. I'll do it until you actually do it. So if you find a Bloomberg, do it soon, because the corporate finance guys are going to descend like locusts. My MBA class is going to descend like locusts, and then they're going to act all proprietary, saying, we're MBAs, you're undergraduates, you can't get on the Bloomberg kind of thing. So get in there before they do. Get the beta printed off. This is a Bloomberg beta page for Disney, using exactly the same 5 years that I used on my Excel regression. So it's exactly the same stock, the same period, the same index, the same monthly returns. So I should get exactly the same answer that I got with the Excel regression, right? I remember the first time I ran a Bloomberg, that's the first thing I checked, is whether I was getting the same numbers from my regression using the raw data as I got from Bloomberg. So let's go down the list. What I'd like you to do is go back to page 125, and stay on the regression at that bottom, because we're going to compare the Bloomberg numbers that I get for Disney with the numbers I got from my regression. Okay? So let's start with the raw beta. You're saying, what's so raw about it? That's actually the regression beta. I'll come back and talk about the adjusted beta in a moment. But the raw beta for Disney is 1.247. What did I get? 1.25. So rounding up, so we're pretty close. So I can live with that. Then I'll skip the adjusted beta. Then the intercept they got was 0.60%. What did I get? 0.712%, I think. So my intercept is a little off. And it used to drive me crazy that I was a little off on both the numbers. I said, how can this be? 5 years, monthly return, same index, same stock. Why am I not getting the same numbers? And the answer is actually very simple. When I ran my regression, how did I compute the returns for Disney? Every month I took the change in the price, and then what else did I bring in? If there was a dividend, I brought in the dividend. Every month for the market, I took in the change in the index, and if there was a dividend, I added the dividend. Bloomberg ignores dividends when they do the market returns. Why? It's too much work. The computer that runs these regressions and coding it must be difficult, so they ignore the dividends. They used to ignore the dividends on the stock as well, which was deadly because if you had a stock where the bulk of your returns came in the form of dividends, they were completely missing it. So the reason we're getting that mismatch is because of that. Is it going to be fatal? Not really. You can see with Disney, I'm getting roughly the same answer. But if you get different answers, that's the reason, is that dividend problem in Bloomberg. It's Bloomberg's problem, not my problem. Okay? Because the right way to do it is to include the dividends in both. They've chosen not to include it. The R squared they get is 73%, which matches up pretty closely to what I got. So it's a pretty close regression. Beta is the same, R squared is the same. The intercept is slightly off, but not by enough to make a difference. The standard error of the beta is 0.10. That matches up as well. Which brings me back full circle to the adjusted beta. You think, what the heck is the adjusted beta? Bloomberg estimates betas for 41,800 companies around the globe. So you go and type this beta page. It's like magic. Any publicly traded company anywhere, it'll give you a beta page. And it's an adjusted beta for each one. The adjusted beta is always equal to the raw beta times 0.67, so keep that in mind, raw beta times 2/3, plus 0.33 times 1. See, what the hell are you doing? So raw beta times 2/3 plus 1/3 times 1. So let's try some numbers. If your raw beta is 1.8, what's your adjusted beta going to look like? 2/3 of 1.8 is 1.2 plus 0.33 is 1.4. So your adjusted beta is going to be 1.53. 1.8 will become 1.53. 1.5 will become 1.33. 1.2 will become 1.13. 0.6 will become 0.73. See what's happening here? What are they doing? They're taking the regression betas and moving them towards 1. What's so magical about 1? There must be a reason. Why 1? Why not 10? Why not 0.8? 1 is the average beta for the market. They're trying to be helpful. They're saying over time your company is probably going to get bigger. It's probably going to get more diversified. It's probably going to get more like the market. Therefore, we're going to move the beta towards 1, to which your response is, please stop helping. Because these weights must be magic weights to work for 41,800 companies, right? Why 2/3 and 1/3? Why not 3/4 and 1/4? Half and half? I could think of 100 different weights. I could ask you where those numbers come from, but it wouldn't be fair. I didn't know. So I called Bloomberg, not the mayor, but the company. Maybe I should have called the mayor then. You know? Maybe he'd have given me the right answer. So they called Bloomberg, and they put me in touch with the beta calculation guy. There's actually a guy at Bloomberg whose life it is to maintain this page. Can you imagine how exciting his life must be? He goes around to a cocktail party and says, I'm the beta guy at Bloomberg. Dozens of people gather around for anecdotes. Not. Guy's pathetically grateful to get a call from the outside world. You know what they do to the guy? Maybe they keep him locked up in a basement room, feed him through a hole in the wall, whatever it is, you know. He says, I'm so glad you called. I have all day to answer your questions. I have all day to ask him questions, but I was afraid if I hung up the phone too soon, he'd do something rash. So after a few minutes of what I thought was polite conversation, I hit him with a question. Why 2/3 and 1/3? 2 minutes of silence. I can hear papers being rustled, terminals being turned off and on. And finally he comes back and says, I don't know, it was here when I got here. I said, what? He said, I was hired 2 years ago, it was already here, don't blame me. I said, I'm not blaming you, I just want to know where the numbers come from. He says, I don't know, here when I got here. I just finished my 11th book, last week actually. I have the title for my 12th book picked out. I haven't written a word of it, but the title's the most critical part anyway. You know what it's going to be called? Here When I Got Here. Because you know how often that is going to be the answer to questions you ask about the place you go to work at? You'll be using a number over and over again. So why are you using this number? I don't know. It's here when I got here. When did you get here? 1979. You've never stopped and asked, no, I just do whatever I'm asked to do. It's amazing how much of finance we've outsourced. People use numbers over and over and over again because that's what everybody else uses. Here when I got here should never be the answer to a question. So if you give me an answer and I don't agree with it, at least we can disagree, we can talk about where the number, but here when I got here, what can I do with that? So the bottom line is, when you look at this page, what should you do with the adjusted beta? Ignore it. All it's telling you is which direction one is, and if you have trouble figuring that out on your own, then maybe you shouldn't be doing corporate finance in the first place. In other words, you want to get started to 2, you want to get to 1, what do you need to do? Go 1.8, 1.6, 1.4, 1.2, 1, you're there. Why do you need some guy holding hands and let me give you a number closer to 1 in case you're confused? That's all this is, right? A number closer to 1. We know which direction 1 is. We can do that on our own. So on this page, just use the regression beta, move on. It's exactly what we did in the Excel spreadsheet. All it does is do what we'd have done in an Excel spreadsheet. So don't think of this as some magical thing that Bloomberg does for you. You could have done this yourself. It just saves you some time. So now we're almost there. Why are we doing this? Because we want a minimum acceptable hurdle rate. We might have lost sight of that as we went risk-free rate, beta, risk premium, but we have everything we kind of need to make our first try at that number. So it's November of 2013. I pulled these numbers together for Disney. The T-bond rate then was 2.75%. Why? Because I'm doing everything in U.S. dollars. I use the T-bond rate as my risk-free rate. The beta that I got from the regression was 1.25. So I took that as my beta for Disney. And the equity risk premium is 5.76%. Do you remember where that came from? Disney gets 82% of its revenues in the U.S., 18% overseas. I took the weighted average, 5.76%. I plugged the numbers in, risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium. I come up with 9.95%. What does that even mean? Let's put some flesh on that number. Yes? Give me the alternative. How do you do a forward-looking regression? See, the problem is, I agree with you. It is a backward-looking number, but all our data isn't. So for a regression, what do I need? I need returns. I can't give you the returns for the next 5 years for Disney. So that's the reality. Our data is backward-looking, and I'll come back to it. Regressions are always going to give you backward-looking numbers. Sometimes it's okay. When is it okay? Is if your company hasn't changed, it's a pretty stable company, using a backward look. So if your company is changing its business mix, its geographical mix, it's going to be more problematic. We'll talk about what to do when you do that. I agree with you entirely. It's a backward-looking number. But I'll also tell you, you have really no choice when it comes to running a regression. So what I'm going to do is put some intuition on the 9.95%, because people going through finance classes do this ad nauseum, risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium. They do it over and over again. They've lost all sight of why we do this. So ready? This is what I'd like you to do. Play the role of potential investors in Disney. You haven't invested in Disney yet. Potential investors in Disney. And I'm going to give you a couple of readings, or a couple of meanings for the 9.95%. You tell me which one is the right way to think about the 9.95%. So each of you is a potential investor in Disney. Here's my first attempt to describe what the 9.95% is telling me. 9.95% is the return you can expect to make in the long term on Disney if the stock is correctly priced and the CAPM is the right model for risk. How many qualifiers are there in that sentence? Let's go through. It's a return you can expect. No guarantees. Already I've added a little. No. In the long term, so don't come to me next year. If the stock is correctly priced, if it's not, all bets are off. And the, so I have four qualifiers in one sentence. I'm an extraordinarily lazy person. If I'm adding four qualifiers, it's because I want to make the statement true. So that is actually technically true. If you lived in an efficient market where everything was fairly priced and the CAPM is the right model for risk, 9.95% is the return you can expect to make on Disney in the long term. I'll also tell you, I don't like that description because it's too passive. Because the only way you can make a higher return then is to do what? The risk-free rate can't be changed. The risk premium can't be changed. What do you have to do? You have to go for a stock with a higher beta. So if you lived in a market where everything were fairly priced, the only way you'd earn a higher return is you have to go for a higher beta investment. Now let me take the second statement. And this is the way I like to think about the 9.95%. 9.95% of the return you need to make on Disney in the long term to break even on your investment. All of a sudden, you become very needy, right? 2.75%, you're not happy with. That's a risk-free rate. Why do you need to make 9.95%? Because it's a risky stock. You need to make 9.95%. And here's why I like it. What did I say I did this morning? I valued GoPro, right? So when I sat down to think about should I invest in GoPro, one of the questions I had to ask was, what return do I need to make on GoPro for it to be a neutral investment? Not even to be happy, just to be a neutral investment. And you bring in the fact that it's a young company in a camera business with a lot of bad stuff going on. I came up with a 10% required return. That's what I need to make. That was even before I did the valuation. I said, this is what I need to make. Then I sat down and looked at what they have. I looked at the Hero 4, the fact they're coming out of the new camera. I looked at the potential camera market, what they could do on social media. I mean, let's face it, GoPro is a company for what I call overactive overshares. You see what they do? They put a camera on your head and you record 5 hours of you going on a hike. Then you put it on YouTube because you want somebody to watch you go on a hike for 5 hours. I guess there's a little market here of crazy people who watch each other go on hikes. But there's a potential social. So basically, when I did my research on GoPro, I had to go through all those steps. Why am I doing that? Because based on my research, I'm going to find out what kind of return I can really make on GoPro, given my views. Let's say I think I can make 22%. What do I need to make? I need to make only 10. I'm making 22. That's, for me, the definition of a good investment. That's why we need the 9.95%. You ask, why do we need the CAPM? The CAPM gives us a benchmark. Without a benchmark, how do I decide whether a stock is a good investment or a bad investment? I have to compare the number I think I can make on that stock to something. All the CAPM is supplying is that benchmark. And it says, you're a risky investment. You need to make more just to break even. Doesn't mean you can't buy the stock. You just have to earn more than that. So the 9.95% becomes the way I think about what I need to make on this investment. Now let's turn things around. You're my potential investors in Disney, right? And you each need to make 9.95% to break even. Let's say I'm the CFO of Disney. You see what this is going to make me? What is this number telling me? I raise what kind of, remember the two ways of raising financing, debt and equity. What did I raise from you? Your stockholder, so I raised equity. And you want to make 9.95% to break even. This is now my cost of equity. We make the cost of equity in this fancy equations and models. The cost of equity is what you, as stockholders in my company, need to make for me to break even. Which means when I go out and make investments as Disney, what's my job? To earn more than 9.95% for you. That's it. It's as simple as that. We make business more complicated than it has to be. I'm not saying it's easy for you to make more than 9.95%, but that's the way I think about business, is I have to generate more than that 9.95%. So that's my cost of equity. If you get that, you got one of the foundational pieces of corporate finance. But an amazing number of people don't get it, including many CFOs of many large companies. I'll give you a story to bring home how much of a disconnect there can be between this number and what people think their equity is actually costing them. It's a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago. I was talking to the CFO of a very large Asian company, publicly traded company. So I sit across the table from him, and out of the blue he says, what do you think my cost of equity is? I think about it for a moment, and I know what business he's in and where he operates. And I think it's about 11%. He said, no, it's 1%. I said, if you know it already, what the hell are you doing asking me what your cost of equity is? He says, why do you think it's only 1%? What do you think he was calling his cost of equity? How can equity have a cost of only 1%? What do you think he was calling his cost of equity? In fact, he was calling his dividend yield his cost of equity. He said, that's all I have to pay out, 1% dividend on my stock price. That's my cost of equity. Now let's take a pause here. When you come up with a cost of equity of 9, 10, or 11% from the CAPM, risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium, it's always going to be much higher than the dividend yield for a stock. In fact, a stock like Google has no dividends at all. So how do you explain the difference between the dividend yield and what you're getting out from the CAPM? What's the extra 9%, 8% for? If I wanted to just get a 1% dividend, why the hell would I be buying your stock, right? I buy your stock because I want the dividend and the price appreciation. I said, if you just deliver 1%, you're going to have some really pissed off stockholders because they're expecting more. And then he asked me a question that floored me. He said, what if I don't deliver the extra 10%? Do you see where he was going? If I borrow money and I have an interest expense and I don't pay it, I go bankrupt. If I raise equity and people think they're going to make 11%, but I deliver only 1%, they can't take me to court. So I had to tell him what would happen. What's going to happen if you consistently keep taking projects that make 1%? I said, your stock price is going to drop. He said, so? I said, then when you raise capital, it's going to cost you more. He said, we're a mature company. We don't plan to raise any money. So now I was in my last legs here. So I'd hit him with the final threat of what would happen if his stock price kept dropping. What will happen to him? You're going to get fired, I said. And he started laughing. He said, do you see the last name on my nameplate? I said, yes. Do you see the last name on the company? I said, yes. Do you see their match? You see where he was going. He was saying, look, this is a family control company. I am never going to get fired, so I'm going to treat equity like it's worth nothing. It is a horrible mindset to bring to business. It's what got Japanese companies into incredible trouble in the 1980s. They thought equity was basically free. And if you think equity is basically free, if I come to you with a project that makes 1%, it looks good to you, right? Because 1% is more than free. So they took 1% projects, and they're still digging themselves out of some of those investments they made 20, 25, 30 years ago. But now do you see why we spend so much time on corporate governance? Because for me to use the 9.95% of the cost of equity, you've got to be afraid as managers of some consequences. And if you're not, then you're going to be looking at equity as if it's costing you only 3, 4, 5%. So later in this class, I'm going to show you what companies around the world look like in terms of what they deliver versus what they need to make. And you're going to be amazed, maybe not, to find out that 55% of companies globally earn well below their cost of capital. And one reason might be there are lots of companies out there that view equity as this cheap way of raising capital because they're not held to consequence. So any questions on the 9.95%? Yes?
Isn't it true, though, if they're not held to consequence?
Yeah, and that's why they keep doing it, right? But in markets where there's corporate governance, ultimately there's that piss-off factor you hit, right? And what happens? Carl Icahn picks on you, and then you're really in trouble. But if I took Carl Icahn out of the picture and Bill Ackman out of the picture and the activist investors out of the picture and let BlackRock decide what should be done, you're absolutely right. No. It's a fundamental weakness of any type of separation between ownership and management. And unfortunately, when you have big companies, you are going to get separation of ownership and management. Nothing you can do about it. No. Any other questions? Yes. No, it just means that the price has to go up 10% year after year, which means that in the short run, it might have to deliver it as higher earnings growth. But as they mature, what's going to happen is the dividend portion, the cash flow portion, is going to go from 1% to 3 to 4 to 5. And the fact that it's a mature company will mean that its cost of equity will come down to 8. So once you get to a mature phase, you're looking at a company that's probably going 2 to 3%. But initially, when you're a high growth, if you invest in LinkedIn, or as I invest in GoPro, I am getting nothing from dividends. If that's what I'm holding out for, it's not happening. It all has to come from price appreciation. So depending on where the company is in the life cycle, you're going to see the mix of debt, the dividend and the price appreciation shift over the life of a company. And you've got to manage the company accordingly, right? That's why we started the company with the financial balance sheet for mature companies versus growth companies. So what I'd like you to do is print off the beta page for your company, right? I'll send you an Excel spreadsheet that will make it easy for you to work out all the mechanical things, but I want you to take your company apart and tell me whether your stock was a good or a bad investment, just like I did for Disney. So use the same template Second, I'd like you to tell me what proportion of your stock's risk comes from the market. Look at the R squared. Third, I'd like you to give me a range on your beta, just like I did, because the beta, the standard error. And finally, I'd like you, and this, if you can do this, you're way ahead on your project. Come up with an expected return for your stock. What would that require from you? You can get the beta from the regression. For the risk-free rate, you'll have to pick a currency and work out. And for the equity risk premium, what do you have to do? Do what I asked you to do last week. As I said, I'll nag you. I'll keep adding to your to-do list. The to-do list is going to get longer and longer and longer if you let it go. So if you can stay on top of your project as we go through, the project will take care of itself. Give me a classic U.S. company. Okay, Verizon. Yeah. No. So that's actually a good question. Everybody get the question? If you do Verizon, what's your risk-free rate going to be? 1.7%. Where does Verizon get all its revenues? In the U.S. So the equity risk premium is the U.S. equity risk premium. You get the beta. You're done. So what? There'll be other parts of the project where it'll get more punishing. On this part, it's going to get easier to do that. But that's not the end game. There are lots of other pieces to come in the puzzle. And then you'll start to see things in Verizon that might be problematic that you might not have seen in a L'Oreal. So try to do that for your company because, as I said, it'll give you... And it's also great preparation for your quiz. So don't view this as parallel paths. Do this as part of the preparation. So now let's start to build on this theme. Let's assume that I'm the CFO of a very risky software company, and you now know enough corporate finance that you can be my consultant. So I come to you and ask you a question. What's my cost of equity? Right? So you've learned the mechanics. You go back, you put in a risk-free rate, a beta. And because I'm a very risky stock, you put in a beta of 3, and you come up with a cost of equity of 20% for me. You come back and tell me my cost of equity is 20%. Am I happy or unpleasantly surprised by this number? As a CFO, do I want a high cost of equity or a low cost of equity? I want a low cost of equity. And I complain and say, this is such a high number. And you tell me why. You tell me it's because my beta is 3 and I'm a risky company. So I have a very simple question. If you can start answering this question, you can start to see what makes betas high for some companies and low for others. So I ask you, can I do something as a company to bring my beta down? You see the advantage. If I can bring my beta down, my cost of equity. So there are at least 3 things I can try to do. Let's see if we can get at least 2 of those 3. In fact, if you get all 3, now the book goes out of the window. Okay? What are the 3 things I can do to bring my... Yes? See, the problem is returns are output, right? So I have to do something. All I can do is run my company, right? So I can't control the outcome. So to make my returns more stable, I have to have earnings that are more stable. Unfortunately, I'm in a risky business. So do you see where I'm going? So I can't control the input. I can't control the output. But build on that first step. Can I make my earnings more stable, even in a risky business? How many of you have the new Microsoft Office? Okay. I remember when I used to go buy Microsoft Office every 3 or 4 years at the bookstore, then I'd upgrade and pay them. Now, of course, when I try to buy Microsoft Office, I have to buy the Office 365 and pay $99 a year. You see, what does that have to do with stable earnings? Software companies historically have had unstable earnings because it's built around the upgrade cycle. So basically, you have high earnings and low earnings for 3 years and high earnings again. Do you see how a premium, this annual premium model, Adobe has the same thing. Is they have an annual premium model? It smooths out your earnings. The first thing I can try to do is maybe I can go to my customers and say, I'll give you a 30% discount if instead of having to sell you stuff every 3 years, you just gave me an annual subscription fee. You can try that, right? So that's the first thing I can try, is to try to change my business structure so my earnings get more stable. So I've named one. I'll act like you did. So what are the other two? If I have debt, what should I do? Reduce the debt. Why? What does the debt do to my earnings that makes my beta higher? When I borrow money, I have to make interest expenses in good times. But this nasty banker keeps insisting that I make interest expenses even in bad times. I don't know what the problem is with this guy. Which means that in good times I make more money. So when I borrow money, the interest expense kind of makes my earnings more unstable. So if I have debt, I should pay it down. I'm not saying it's a good thing to do, but if I want a lower beta, that'll do it. Think of interest expenses. What made it such a problem? It was a fixed cost, right? If there are other fixed costs I have as a company and I can make them variable, you say, how the heck am I going to do that? What's the essence of outsourcing? What are you doing? Instead of having copiers all over your office and paying for those copiers, you outsource copying. What does that accomplish for you? What used to be a fixed cost has now become a variable cost. Your union negotiates with you. And they say, we want $15 wages. And you say, I'll give you $16 on one condition. If you have bad times, the wage is knocked down to $12. You're building a more flexible wage structure. Of course, don't offer them $14 and a more, because then they're not going to buy it. Offer them more and say, look, in return for that. Three basic things we talked about. There's one other way, which is kind of cheating. How do I get this beta? I go to Bloomberg and I run a regression, right? If you get a chance, 15 minutes on a Bloomberg, try this out. Take your stock, try 5 years, then try 2 years for the regression, then try weekly, then try monthly, then change the index. And I'll tell you, you give me 15 minutes with a Bloomberg terminal, I can deliver whatever beta you want for your company if you allow me to play with the parameters. And you don't think analysts do this all the time? What you see as the printed page is what they claimed the beta was. How the hell do you know that this wasn't the 23rd try that delivered the beta that they wanted? You know why I didn't suggest that? Because it's cheating. My beta is not changing. It just looks like it's changed. And I'll give you the analogy to bring this home. Every morning when I wake up at like 5:35. I get on the treadmill. 32 minutes, I'm done. That's it for the day. I can do whatever I want. I can eat whatever I want for the rest of the day. All the French fries I want. So this is my, hey, I can screw up the rest of the day kind of thing. And my dream, as long as I've gotten on the treadmill, which is like 25 years, is to burn off 1,000 calories in 32 minutes. I've tried everything. I put the treadmill at 12. Doesn't work. Until one day, I found the trick. You know what that is? When you get on, what's the first thing it asks you? How much do you weigh? Try this out. Enter 500 pounds, and it's amazing how the calories just roll off. You walk, 100 calories gone. You run, 1,000 calories gone. You run for 32 minutes, you're burning off 10,000 calories because of the stupid treadmill. First thing, if somebody gets up on you and says, I weigh 500 pounds, the treadmill should say, get off. Right? But I could change the weight to 500 pounds, but the reality is in 32 minutes, if I can get to 500 calories, I'm lucky, because with my weight, that's the best I can do. That's a way to think about playing games with the beta, is you can make it look like you burnt off 1,500 calories, but you're still burning off exactly what it did the previous day. And in fact, one final question. So there are three things you can do to bring your beta down. You can, in fact, if you want to bring your beta to zero in a week, can you do it? What do you have to do? Liquidate your business and take the cash and put it into treasury bills. I didn't say it was a good thing to do. You'll have a nice riskless company. It'll be like a money market fund. So that's why getting your beta down can't be your end game as a company. So take whatever beta you have and try to deliver a return higher than that beta, and you should be okay. So let me close off with some regression pages for my other companies. So I did Tata Motors. Here's my regression page for Tata Motors. Again, let me hit the high points. The beta for Tata Motors based on this regression was 1.83. That's a regression of Tata Motors against the Sensex. Beta 1.83. The range with the 67% confidence is 1.67 to 1.99, plus or minus one standard error. R squared was 69%. If I trust this regression, 69% of Tata Motors' risk comes from the market, 31% from the firm. The Jensen's alpha for Tata Motors on an annualized basis was 35.4%. What does that tell you? You wish you'd bought Tata Motors. That's all it tells you. Because over the 5 years, it was an incredibly good investment. You know what made it such a good investment? What gave them all that China exposure? There are no in fact, if you go to China, you will not see a single Tata automobile on the road. Not one. You know who they bought in 2009, Tata Motors? They bought Jaguar Land Rover. And for whatever reason, the Chinese seem to like these gigantic Land Rovers. Where they drive them, I don't know. Okay? But that's been the best investment Tata Motors has made in the last 5 years because they bought it from the right seller. Ford sold it in 2009, Jaguar Land Rover, because they wanted to get rid of it. At any cost, they just gave it away pretty much. That's a 35.4%. In fact, if I plug in the risk-free rate, if you remember the rupee risk-free rate was 6.57%, there's my beta, the equity risk premium for Tata Motors given their revenue exposure, which is 23.7% India, 23.4% China, 7.19%, gives me a rupee cost of equity for Tata Motors of 19.73%. For Vale, I faced a choice. There are two ways I can get a beta for Vale. One is I can run a regression against the Bovespa because it's a Brazilian stock, but it also has an ADR. You know what ADRs are? These are actually Brazilian stocks that are listed and traded in the New York Stock Exchange. So you can actually run a regression against the S&P 500. I get very different betas and R-squareds and Jensen's alphas. Which one should I use? The right answer is neither. They're both screwed up in different ways. But for whatever reason, people think because the S&P 500, it's better. Therefore, these are both bad regressions. And that's what I meant about how your choices can drive. So if you have a stock that is an ADR, don't even bother emailing me which regression. Just pick one, run the regression, diagnose it. The numbers are going to be different, but it is what it is. And I'm going to leave you with the last page. For Deutsche, I ran a regression against the DAX, which is the German index. I also ran it against the FTSE. Euro 100, because it's part of a European index. Right? For Baidu, in the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. So in each one, I'm doing exactly what I did for Disney, but I'm starting to dig a grave for regression betas. I don't trust them. They're backward-looking, as you pointed out. He's gone already. Right? Yeah. They're backward-looking, but they're also noisy. Don't worry. I don't tell him I noticed, you know, so it's okay. Yeah. They're also noisy. And they cannot be trusted going forward. So I will see you on Wednesday. And if you can, print off the beta page for your company and bring it with you. Hi, how are you?
I emailed you over the weekend because I was doing my report for my company and it's getting acquired by another company in the industry. It's fine. Okay, thank you so much.
Yes.
No Wi-Fi.
So
if you have downloaded as a PDF file, so just download the PDF file so it's on your iPad. Yes?
R-squared tells you the proportion of the risk that's market. Beta tells you the number of units of market. So it's like the proportion of your weight that's body fat and the pounds of body fat, right? So that's why if you have a lot of fat, if you have big... If you're a diversified investor, you're going to get rid of all that firm-specific risk anyway, right? So it doesn't matter if the R-squared is 80 or 20. By the time you're done, you're focusing on...
Okay, wait, one more thing.
Yeah.
You were saying the three ways of reducing beta. So you were saying to...
change your business model to make your earnings more stable.
Right?
Second is pay down debt, if you have any, because interest expenses make your earnings more volatile. Third, reduce fixed costs, if you have a lot of fixed costs.
Okay, got it.
Take the sectors that you can come in with the company to probably add to your case. say, look, I'm interested in technology as well. I'd like to do this kind of company. So go there. If you have trouble still, then contact me. Hey, how are you?
We're just wondering about the review sessions. Like, we can't really make it. So is there going to be any video or something?
Not of the TA video review session. My review session next Tuesday will be recorded.
Okay. But the TA sessions are
no, they're not
so is there anything we can, like, do they have slides or something?
You can go and talk to them. There's nothing special they do. They just take past quizzes and work through the prompts. It's actually the prompts and the solutions from past quizzes. So basically, if you have, and all the past quizzes and solutions are online, so you can download them and start doing it yourself, because that's all they do.
So that would be the same.
Exactly. Oh, okay. And then you can go in, if you have a question about a particular type of problem, you can go to the TAs and talk to them, or come in and talk to them.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. Yeah.
Hi, how are you?
How are you? I just want to ask you, for the company that I'm analyzing, they report revenue by location, but then they have a bunch of subsidiaries for which they support that as other revenue.
So is that fully owned subsidiaries? Partially?
It's Adidas. They own, like, Reebok. And so they say where they make revenues per location, but then for the...
You have to work with what you have. So just, that's all they give you. That's all they give you.
So for those, no. So I'm using for the equity premium for those areas. But then for the last one, I thought, should I just use, like, the United States or Germany, or should I use just, like, the average of, like, do a weight-based...
Just use U.S.
Thing.
Use
U.S.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Hi. I have a question about corporate openings. In my company, the CEO is also the chairperson of also the major shareholder. So for corporate governance analysis, is it tiered to shareholders or is it tiered to...
It's tiered to one shareholder. So it's not to shareholders collectively, it's to that one shareholder.
But what actually he does is he has different kinds of shares. He owns...
It doesn't matter, right? It's a very simple question. If you owned 1,000 shares in this company... Forget about him. Think about you, right? So in a sense, we know he has a lot of power. He chairs the committee. He owns a lot of shares. There's nothing to do with it. This is about an individual shareholder of the company who's not him, and asking how much power will that person have to create change in the company. What do you think the answer to that is going to be? No, that's it. That's your corporate governance. Right?